strategy and insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast, where we discuss the fundamental questions around the future of healthcare. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Thomas. I'm your host for this podcast, and apart from that, a partner in the pharma life science practice at Strategy End. Today, our conversation will focus on ecologically sustainable practices in healthcare. And I'm delighted and honored to introduce my guest for today, which is Dr. Jody Sherman from the Yale School of Medicine. And despite being on different continents, we're connecting virtually with me in Frankfurt and Jody in New Haven, Connecticut. And without further ado, let me introduce Jody and, as I find, very captivating background. Jody is an associate professor of anesthesiology and epidemiology in environmental health sciences of the Yale School of Medicine. She's also the founding director of the Yale Program on Healthcare and Environmental Sustainability in the Yale Center on Climate Change and Health. And in addition to that, Jody serves as the medical director of sustainability for Yale New Haven Health System and is an internationally very recognized academic in the emerging field of sustainability in clinical practice and care. Her research actually focuses on studying the pollution impacts from healthcare delivery itself and around finding ways to mitigate those emissions while promoting resilient and also sustainable healthcare systems. Next to that, Jody is the co-director of the Lancet Planetary Health Commission on Sustainable Healthcare and part of the Committee on Environmental Health of the American Society of Anesthesiology. And I'm still not done because Jody is a member of the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change. And she's in this contributing as an analyst to the UK National Health Service Net Zero Initiative and also serves on the National Academy of Medicine Action Collaborative for decarbonization in the US health sector. Prior to all of that, Jody earned her MD at the State University of New York and completed her residency at the Stanford University Medical Center. In addition to her medical background, and that is also very interesting, she holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the University of Connecticut and is also a licensed massage therapist, which is specialized in sports injuries and chronic pain management. So having said that, really feeling very privileged to have you, Jody, with us today, and I'm personally impressed by your very remarkable career.
Thanks for having me, Thomas.
So even with my somewhat extensive introduction, your remarkable career obviously spans much more than I just summarized. And before deep diving into any of your current responsibilities, let me pivot a bit into your earlier years of your career journey. Prior you pursued your medical career, you obtained, as I said, your bachelor's degree in philosophy and also underwent a training as a massage therapist. Could you share a bit how these, let's say, diverse paths unfolded and which of the learnings from those experiences remain still significant to you today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of an unusual path I've had, very convoluted. And I would say that it differs, obviously, by country. But in the United States, it's pretty typical to get a four-year bachelor's degree and then to go on to a four-year medical degree and then to go on to residency training, which is anywhere from 3 to 10 years, depending on the specialization that is chosen. And, you know, for me, the decision to go into a career in medicine was a late decision. So I would say early on when I was an undergraduate student, I really didn't know what I wanted to do and was exposed to philosophy and, you know, thought I think this way all the time. I didn't realize you could major in it. And so, you know, it was a clear decision for a course of study to me, which is really just, you know, big ideas and really just the fundamental, just the foundations of everything. I mean, that's why we have PhDs, doctors in philosophy. And, you know, in particular, I was attracted to metaphysics and epistemology. And in short, what is and how do we know, which is the foundations of science, the foundations of ethics, the foundations of everything. So I just naturally was attracted to that kind of thinking. And after that degree, I actually got a job working for an academic journal publishing company, Elsevier, which is pretty well known in New York City.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Just, you know, what do you do with a degree in philosophy? You do something related to publishing, probably. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. So it was sort of a temporary step. And, you know, while I was in my early 20s and just working out, doing a lot of exercising, got interested in the martial arts and had some sports injuries. And conventional medicine really didn't have anything for me because what was going on for me wasn't operable. I was already doing more than physical therapists could offer. So I accidentally discovered manual medicine, things like osteopathy, chiropractic massage, and it just instantaneously helped me. And I thought it was really great. And why didn't my orthopedic surgeon know about this? And I tried connecting them and there was resistance. And again, I don't know how it is in Europe, but there was a great divide between manual therapies and conventional medicine in the United States. And so I started reading about the history of medicine and why this came to be in the United States. And I felt very motivated to go to medical school and try and make a difference. And that there are all these therapies out there that are low risk, right? You know, if you go surgery, you can't go back. But if you're able to do something manually instead, you can avoid all that, you know, just as an example. So anyway, I decided to go to massage therapy first because it helped me out so tremendously. And then while I was in my massage training, I'm like, yeah, I need to go to medical school. So anyway, it's a bit of an unusual career, but to me, it's all connected. And how do I use it today? I would say that firstly, my training hands-on, the high touch, if you will, interactions with patients is perhaps the most meaningful and healing. You know, there's a difference between health and well-being. Like we can't always achieve health, but there's probably the most important thing that happens is the interactions with patients. And so the hands-on touch really matters. And so not only is it soothing to my patients, but I also get information, whether I'm doing a heart and lung exams, you know, it's connecting to the patient at the same time as I'm getting information. Or as an anesthesiologist, I do a lot of interventions, whether it's putting in IVs or arterial catheters, catheters that go in the veins and the arteries, or doing perineural injections to numb up areas that are about to be operated on. These are all technical skills that my hands-on training have been helpful for. But, you know, in terms of how this, you know, relates to my current career and sustainability, I would say that just thinking deeply about the world's problems and also that there are things more important to healing and well-being than high-tech medical interventions. And we really ought to be thinking more broadly about all these things.
So the bottom line, it sounds at the beginning of your career or academic life, it was a bit of a finding your path inspired then by personal needs that you had. And that's how your career kind of started and evolved and happened over time, it sounds very much like. And there is elements that you can draw from that into the here and now. I'm intrigued by asking how much of the hands-on, high-touch patient interactions do you still have? Is that kind of the 50% of your day or rather the 10% of your day anymore?
Oh, yeah. No, it's closer to 75% of my time right now, but it varies depending on research awards. But yes, no, I'm very much involved in day-to-day patient care.
Okay. I mean, I was alluding to at the beginning that you're obviously an associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine. At the same time, you are practicing and also you are the medical director for sustainability. So kind of juggling simultaneously clinical research, clinical practice, but also to a certain extent, clinical administration. If you would need to make someone understand at a social gathering or what have you, asking you what you do for a living, how would you best describe those three roles and what's kind of the theme that you have?
I mean, it's a little bit of a tough question and I answer it differently depending on who's asking. But, you know, my research is related to my administrative role, which is if I can't implement or understand the challenges of implementing solutions in this space and be inspired by the problems in this space, then the research is really very disconnected. So those go hand in hand. And I, as a clinician, see firsthand what the problems are and the challenges are. You know, if you're a peer administrator, you tend to be disconnected from what's happening in the trenches. And if you're a peer researcher, you tend to be disconnected from not only what the problems are, or even if you know what they are, the implementation challenges. So, but in short story, you know, I just say that you know, my work is on trying to improve the environmental performance of care delivery.
And what actually inspired you to get that focus into your research, that you want to work on sustainability in clinical care? And when was that kind of pivoting moment when this passion kind of became obvious?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very common story. I think anybody working in the space would have the same answer. I mean, my background is convoluted, but it all sort of came to that there are systems issues, big issues to consider, and things like natural therapies are part of the armamentarium that are very important when we think about healthcare delivery. For me, so that came to me before medical school and residency, but really the light bulb for me happened during my residency training, where I was finally directly responsible for patient care. And it's so obvious that we're using so much stuff. It's coming from somewhere that's invisible. It's going somewhere that's invisible. Clearly, there's tons of pollution happening. And there's so much waste in the process of care delivery and unnecessary low-value care and unnecessary high-tech care. There's clearly a big problem in how care is being delivered in high-income nations today. And I felt morally challenged by this, that as much as I enjoyed taking care of patients, it's clear I'm harming the planet at the same time, and I need to do a better job. And I made a pact with myself that I would only practice if I could help find solutions in this space. And at the time, there was no information about healthcare pollution being a problem. I mean, there was literally one very dated study about, you know, the amount of solid waste coming out of hospitals, but that was it. And so there was literally no information on how to do better, how big the problem even is. And so that really started my journey as a researcher, where I started partnering with environmental engineers who have methods of quantifying those environmental impacts to help us identify where the hotspots are to drive practice improvement. And, you know, but it started out as a trainee. I mean, the problem is so obvious. And if you ask any clinician in the space right now, I'm sure they will tell you the same thing. The problem was so obvious. I am morally conflicted about this, and I have to make a difference.
And I mean, just because you mentioned that waste that is going out of a clinic, meanwhile, do big clinics actually weigh the tons of waste that a hospital
That's a really great question. So a few things, and I will say that, you know, that was sort of the intro study. But, you know, we get so disturbed by seeing all this stuff coming out unused or even used, but all the packaging. We get so disturbed by seeing all that. But much of the footprint isn't even about what happens after the waste leaves the facility. A lot of it has to do in the manufacturing and the transportation processes upstream.
Got it.
But I didn't know that until I started partnering with the environmental engineers. It was just clear that we had an obvious problem. But to answer your question of, like, you know, do we weigh this stuff? I will tell you, I don't know what it's like in Germany and Europe. I will tell you in the United States that there was, I will call it a deregulation or decentralization regulation around this back in the late 90s. So I have no information on how much waste there is coming out of US hospitals and even in my own hospital, because our waste vendor, you know, we have contracts based on things like numbers and types of waste bins. I mean, there's at least 13 different waste streams in the hospital setting. So it's very complicated. There's more than one waste vendor. Some of them, you know, just do a certain number of bin tips or bin pickups, depending on the size of the bins, each week. And if they charge by the number of pickups, they're incentivized to do it more frequently than is necessary. And some things are by volume, some things are by weight. And unless you as an individual or have staff in your organization do physical audits of the waste, which, you know, by the way, if you're really going to get into it, is an occupational hazard, a little bit risky. So it's not the best way. But, you know, it is very difficult to know how much and the type of waste coming out of healthcare facilities. I don't know what it's like in Europe, but I can't tell you the number out of my own institution. I can't tell you the number in the United States.
But to be honest, I couldn't for Germany or Europe either, to be honest, but was just intrigued asking. Yeah. But the thing is, Also, you mentioned you didn't know where the waste is actually coming from before you really entrenched yourself in. And that means also you can only consciously use something if you are aware of something along those lines. And being a medic myself, sustainability clearly was not on the curriculum, at least when I studied. But now looking at the new generation of healthcare professionals, what's the role that you believe that environmental impact on healthcare should actually play in the education and the training of the next generation of practitioners?
That's a really great question. So there has been a lot of activity for several years now. I mean, I'm going to speak specifically about doctor training. I don't have insight into other professions. But for several years now, there has been a push to get education on climate change into the preclinical classroom years of medical education. And there are now studies of activity in this space in numerous countries and across the world, in fact. So there's a trend of this happening. There are published learning objectives. There are different ways of doing this, whether it's through dedicated training versus integrating into, for example, the pathology curriculum, you know, that already exists. You know, what are some of the disease states that can be seen from climate change? So there's ways of working in. And even though there are some published learning objectives, what's really absent is what happens in the clinical years of medical education. And not only, you know, I mean, we see all sorts of diseases, whether or not it's tied to a climate change related event. We would never make that attribution as a clinician. We may see things like more pulmonary exacerbation cases in the emergency rooms during heat waves or, you know, for example, in the United States, when Canada's wildfires is very much impacting air quality in the United States. So we're seeing increased emergency department visits. But we can't, as clinicians, make that attribution to climate change. So, epidemiologically, it's very hard to make that connection. And what we can say is, you know, retrospectively, there is an increased number of visits related to air quality, related to wildfires, for example. So working that into the clinical curriculum, that's one aspect of at least being aware that these things are happening. But also the important thing that I think is really absent, and that is how to be resource stewards. And, you know, when you're a young trainee and better be safe than sorry, better to order more tests or do more until you know better than to miss something. And that's sort of the general approach. And it's not completely wrong, but we can do a better job of, you know, so there's two ways of really being better resource stewards. And one is in the indicated care to not use things unnecessarily and then to avoid things that are not indicated altogether. And it takes a while to learn that as a trainee. But part of the problem is that those behaviors are not being modeled. And that's because the teachers, the educators are not trained in this space, which means we have to involve the professional societies. So professional societies have to get involved to require this education for postgraduate training or residency training, and also to have required content in professional society meetings for educating our educators. So this is starting to happen, and I can speak to my own specialty in anesthesia. That said, you know, because it's not yet required content, some years it's there, some years it's not. It depends on the whims of whoever's in charge of the conference. And so this really needs to be codified as required training. Being resource stewards, regardless of political position, has to be required training and should be ingrained in all professional society education and requirements and continuing education.
And I mean, Jody, with that podcast, obviously, we are also reaching listeners that are very much in the healthcare field. And also for my educational purposes, if we talk healthcare pollution, what are the 3 to 5 biggest buckets of pollution that you would see to help us understand where the pollution occurs? I mean, you mentioned earlier also in the production of healthcare solutions, hardware and the like, there is a lot of pollution happening. But can you help us kind of what those buckets are for our educational purposes?
Yeah, sure. I mean, people talk about the greenhouse gas protocol, which, mm-hmm. you know, I think is helpful framing for organizations for external reporting and accountability. But I think it's not really helpful framing for healthcare professionals and how we approach clinical care delivery. But, you know, so I will put it into two general buckets. And one is the energy intensity of the facilities and transportation. So we don't have control as clinicians over things like the energy sources in our buildings and, you know, whether or not there's new construction that is more energy efficient or retrofitting. I mean, we can get involved in our organizations to try and influence those things. But one big bucket is sort of the energy efficiency and the cleanness of the energy sources. Where we do have some influence there as clinicians are through things like, can we have a virtual visit? Do we need to see someone in person? Do we need to see someone at all? Can we communicate via an email system, a confidential email system? So, and there are ways of doing this securely. We've had to, you know, really ramp up the development. They predated the pandemic, but was certainly rapidly developed with the pandemic. So virtual care is a really important part of that. And also the whether or not that care needs to actually occur is a big part of that. And but developing things like more efficient clinics, like having a multidisciplinary clinic. So patients coming in to see one specialist, can they see all the related specialists in the same visit? You know, so having that concentration of care is also better for everyone, including, you know, the patient doesn't have to take the time to come back for multiple visits. So beyond the environmental piece, there's also, it's just preferable to not have to take more time out of your life to have these visits. So that's sort of the thinking about sort of the energy side of things. But the biggest area has to do with the supply chain, the consumption of the supplies that we use, medical devices, pharmaceuticals, supplies, all these things are the biggest environmental footprint area. So again, the two general ways I like to approach this is, do we need all the stuff in delivering the right care? And the other question, is it the right care to begin with? And, you know, in general, we should be, you know, thinking, is this the right care to begin with? But again, there, you know, it's not so simple. And in part because of financial remuneration systems. So if we are incentivized to see patients, incentivized to do more procedures, incentivized to do certain interventions, whether it's, you know, prescriptions or devices, you know, depending on where one is in the world, that is a driver of overconsumption, unnecessary utilization of things. And so we really need to think more deeply about those drivers as well.
This is actually a very good segue, because our healthcare systems or sick care systems are primarily driven by the consumption and the volume that is generated, the number of patients you see, the number of MRI scans you make, the number of drugs are prescribed, so on and so forth, right? But if we talk now preventative measures, we are also preventing this to happen down the road. And if I listen to you also, we're contributing to sustainability in healthcare if we are doing sometimes things not, and we are shying away from procedures and we are pivoting to virtual care and visits and emails and probably even Gen AI and decision support for individuals on the rise. I mean, all of that, right, is also a solution to wasting unnecessarily. What's your perspective on that? I mean, this would mean really a fundamental change of how we think healthcare and how also we incentivize professionals as well as producers in the healthcare space. It's a fundamental mindset shift, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up. And I've published a couple of papers with my colleague, Dr. Andrew McNeil, who's the co-chair of the Lancet Commission on Sustainable Healthcare, what we've called the Planetary Healthcare Framework. And so we've talked about essentially one of those three pillars so far, and that really is addressing the unnecessary care and unnecessary utilization of stuff in the delivery care. Another pillar, which we can come back to after, is the circular economy. But the one you're talking about is the primary one, and that is preventing disease to begin with, moving way upstream, you know, making sure people have the conditions to support health and wellness to begin with. So, and it's better access to primary care that remunerates and supports preventative measures, and not just, you know, what's considered primary and secondary prevention, you know, things like disease screening and vaccinations. But moving even further upstream than that, you know, things like diet and access to green spaces, but ensuring that we're also, and this is not our job as clinicians, but it is fundamental to our work as clinicians. And that is addressing the social determinants of health, that that people have livable wages, that they have access to affordable housing and affordable transportation and affordable internet, and that they have access to a healthy and clean environment. That, you know, and typically the most impoverished neighborhoods are where we put our medical waste incinerators, our power plants, our chemical refineries. And so the patients who are the poorest and least able to advocate for themselves are the ones that are also at the highest exposures, highest risk, and with the least resource to address them. And when you have, you know, we have a social system, a healthcare system in the United States. And so those patients who don't have health insurance, who don't have finance, will show up very late with advanced disease. And we treat them, we treat everyone. Yeah. But it would certainly be better from an environmental perspective if we prevented that disease to begin with. And that includes having social structures that support the social determinants of health, which is outside healthcare delivery, but certainly related to.
I mean, bottom line, it's not an easy task overall because it's so interconnected, right? What you just described. Now, coming from the more research side of things and also high-level strategies on how to cope with it towards more real solutions. And you mentioned earlier that you are really interested in finding actual solutions. And back in 2013, under your initiative, the Yale New Haven Clinics took actually a step that was surprising, at least at the time, to discontinue the use of desflurane, which is known as one of the most environmentally damaging and also expensive anesthetic gases that we're having. And despite this continuous use of the gas in many other clinics, you, by doing so, also developed a so-called Yale Gassing Greener app, which is an environmental protection app for anesthesiologists that provides kind of a quick overview of the environmental pollution they can avoid by opting for, let's say, less harmful anesthetics. Could you probably briefly explain to us how the app works, and also share some of the outcomes that you have observed thus far?
Sure. And I would say this is really the third pillar of the planetary healthcare framework, and that is essentially improving the environmental performance of the supply chain. So through things like environmentally preferable choices of medications and supplies, where we have the information and where we don't have the information, simply reducing waste. But in the case of anesthetic gases, we published, I would say it's now a landmark paper back in 2012, looking at the environmental impact of the four predominant inhaled anesthetic gases, desflurane, sevoflurane, isoflurane, and nitrous oxide, and an intravenous general anesthetic alternative, propofol. And what we found was that of the inhaled anesthetics, desflurane and nitrous oxide were greatly outweighed the footprint in equipotent doses, about 40 to 50 times the other inhaled anesthetic alternatives. And compared to the intravenous propofol alternative, there is about four orders of magnitude difference for an equipotent dose. So based on this information, we were able to, based on environmental grounds, you know, the biggest offender of the inhaled anesthetic. So that's just their comparative footprint. Then you have to look at the footprint of your organization. Mm-hmm. And if your organization uses a lot of desflurane and nitrous oxide, then those should be really the target of elimination. And because their footprint is so much greater than the other inhaled anesthetic alternatives, they are easily anywhere from 50 to 90% of the footprint. And so if you can just address those, you can greatly reduce the overall impact of your organization. So based on this research, and also because desrain is the most costly, we were able to get rid of it in 2013. And I'll say that part of that has to do with we have alternatives. We have, you know, inhaled anesthetic alternatives. We have general anesthetic alternatives, intravenous. We can even avoid general anesthetic in some cases, doing what's called regional anesthesia. The most familiar example would be if a woman has a spinal anesthetic before she has a cesarean section. So it just numbs up part of the body. So you don't have to go all the way off to sleep. So sometimes there are alternatives to inhaled anesthetics or general anesthetics altogether. So based on this research, we were able to firstly just get rid of desrain. And we did this on environmental grounds and also cost grounds because it was the most expensive drug back in 2013. Now, it's been slow to catch on. There have been, you know, some organizations since, but now there is sweeping policy reform in Scotland and across England, and also policy reform happening in Europe, trying to phase out desrain altogether.
Okay.
That's great. And now there's a lot of movement to reduce or get rid of nitrous oxide. Now, nitrous oxide has slightly different properties without getting too technical. You know, for desrain, there are alternative inhaled anesthetics if you need them. For nitrous oxide, it also is used as not just as a general anesthetic. It's also used as an analgesic or for pain control. So you don't necessarily have to use it to go all the way off to sleep, but it can be used to reduce pain. Most commonly, people may know it as laughing gas used by dentists. And it is also used for not so much in the United States, but heavily in other parts of the world, including the UK, including Europe, for so-called natural delivery, which, you know, I get a kick out of that. But so eliminating it altogether is a bit more challenging because it doesn't have the same alternatives as something like desrain does. But, you know, in the case of nitrous oxide, what has been discovered on several continents now, that the vast majority of the medication is lost through the, it is piped through the walls of the facility. And most of the, like 90% of the gas is lost at the connection between the tank and the manifold piping in the facilities. And if you just get rid of the piping and have a local tank for on-demand use, then you can get rid of 90% of the emissions of that medication. But part of the issue is that it's dirt cheap. So in the case of desrain, the case is easy. You can get institutions on board because it's so expensive. In the case of nitrous oxide, motivating organizations to move to portable tanks is a lot harder because it's dirt cheap.
I mean, next to gases that are kind of in itself a pollution, also one could think about single-use versus reusable healthcare products. And obviously, while you minimize material and energy consumption and waste overall, it does require after each use that we heavily prevent any cross-contamination. And that in itself results, again, in increased resources and energy usage. How do you navigate with that, I would say, delicate balance between disinfection efforts and environmental impact at the same time, because you don't want to have any cross-contamination. At the same time, you're reusing healthcare products to improve any footprint there. Do you have a perspective on that as well?
Yeah, and let me just back up because I didn't fully answer your first question. Just say that the smartphone app it's a clinical teaching tool. So it's really for clinicians to teach their students about the different options of drugs and what the footprints are and the implications of waste. And so that's the virtue of that tool. And for your question about reusable versus disposables, I think it's important to point out that there is a massive movement by equipment manufacturers and I would say drug manufacturers too, because they make packages bigger than they need to be. There's gaming the system that's happening, and we should come back to the drug example. Industry is manufacturing obsolescence. So for things that are difficult to clean, cheap to make, things like needles, syringes, IV tubings, of course, those should not be reusable. But right now, there's this trend of everything becoming single-use disposable. So things like complex, expensive surgical instruments that cost more than $1,000 each. And we take care of thousands of patients in any one institution. So tons of money just being tossed versus simple low-risk things like blood pressure cuffs, mm-hmm. bed pillows, bed linens, things that are very low-risk to begin with. Everything's becoming disposable. And it's an industry is essentially the driving argument is infection prevention, you know, zero harm. The quest for zero harm trumps everything else, you know, but that's not... There are several problems. Firstly, zero harm is unattainable. So we should aim to minimize harm, but we can't aim to zero harm at all costs. And this is, there's historically been this tension just from a financial perspective. Before there was even any awareness of the environmental harms of throwing things away. But I will say from the infection prevention perspective, the argument is there, but the evidence by and large is not. We reuse thousands of different types of things every single day in a hospital, and we do so safely, and we have done so for years. And so identifying high risk from an infection perspective devices and whether or not there can be a system solution for reusable should really trump any assumption that everything ought to be single use disposable. But by and large, when you review the evidence, there it is really lacking to suggest that single-use disposables is better from an infection prevention perspective. And again, I'm not including those things that, you know, things like needles and IV catheters and tubing, not stuff like that. But, you know, the evidence is lacking. And that's because, you know, it is very difficult to attribute risk to any one thing. The environment is dirty, even a so-called sterile surgery. Is not perfectly sterile. That we try and make it as sterile as possible, but it's not perfectly sterile. That is not achievable. And we can contaminate something just by our handling, just by being in the environment, just by the manufacturing process. We can contaminate something that is single-use disposable just as easily as we can something that is reusable. So we have to be much more careful and selective in what things ought to be single-use disposable and what ought to be reusable. Right now, it's just this assumption everything should be disposable. And now there's starting to be awareness that that's not the best assumption, not from a cost perspective, not from a supply chain resilience perspective, as we learned through the pandemic when we ran out of things that could have been reusable, like gowns and drapes. And certainly not from an environmental perspective and not just climate change. We're also worried about other types of pollution, including plastic pollution.
And you also made a quick hint around drugs and too big of packages being produced. And you want to also shed some light there. Could you do that, please? Because that is also very interesting, of course, because I mean, knowing it for myself and the surrounding of mine, a lot of the drugs are going to be wasted because by the time you need them, they've expired, to be frank.
Right. So, I mean, there's expiration of packages that are still on the shelf, and then there's expiration of something that you know, once you open something, the clock ticks much more quickly in terms of when it expires. But so there's expiration dating. There's also making packages much bigger than a patient needs and all sorts of measures in place to prevent using them on a subsequent patient. And in the United States, for example, it could be because one patient bought that package. So even if you only use half of it, you can't use that on the next patient because then how are you going to pay for that? Or how is that patient going to pay and the other patient not pay? Or it could be, you know, we have regulations in place that say, you can't, even if it's a multi-dose vial, meaning it has additives that are preservatives to prevent bacterial growth, even if it's that type of vial, we can't use it on the subsequent patient if it's open in a patient care area, because what if it got contaminated? Or yeah, I learned of an example in the UK where, for example, the size of number of doses of antibiotics for pediatric ear infection based on the standard dose, which, you know, I'm making it up. Let's say it's, you know, once a day for 3 weeks. The package size might be 20. So you have to buy a second dose if you're going to really adhere, or doing some deep market research, maybe the package size is 15. So you still have to buy two packages and it's more than you need. And so either it sticks around and expires or you just throw it out. So that's what I mean by gaming the system. And there was a study that was the highlight of a paper in the Washington Post a number of years ago, just looking at cancer drugs alone in the United States, that this issue of oversized vials, as it's called, or oversized packages, costs $3 billion in just this one class of drugs just in the United States, just in 1 year. And this was already many years ago. So this is part of the gaming of the system, gaming the system for consumption. So the challenge is that the business model, whether it's devices and supplies, whether it's medications, the business model is to sell more stuff.
Got it. And that reminds me, and everyone who is listening and interested in learning more there, have a listen into episode number 20, because I had a conversation with Professor Christian Franken, who is a founder and also managing shareholder of Dihesis as a company. And they actually are in a good position to 2D and 3D print drugs on demand. Yeah? So also in terms of size and packaging, fit for purpose and more personalized to what you actually need. But fast forwarding from the here and now, Jody, how do you see the future of healthcare sustainability evolving, let's say in the next decade? And what are the related hopes that you would have for the industry in terms of both, of course, environmental impact and reduction of that, and the patient outcomes at the same time?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that, especially the last point that, you know, that we have to be very careful that we're not just looking at emissions. And I prefer the term sustainability to climate change or carbon or decarbonization, because the pollution problem is bigger than greenhouse gas emissions. But we tend to default to that language in part because we have more robust means of quantifying and more robust regulatory structures in place. So it's sort of the default language. But I think we have to be very careful to avoid greenwashing. Uh-huh. That means we need clear standards and transparency around reporting what emissions are. And we talk about voluntary measures using market forces or regulatory measures to require drawing down of those emissions. But greenwashing is a big problem. It can be intentional, where a company wants you to think their product is green, so you select it. Or it can be unintentional, where you think you're doing the right thing. You heard this intervention was a good thing to do. For example, focusing on pounds of recycling in your institution. Recycling is such a low environmental benefit and is so labor intensive when you're talking about a complex clinical environment to manage versus moving upstream to preventing waste to begin with. So greenwashing can be unintentional. Oh, we saved, X pounds of recycling, because we recycled. Meanwhile, staff can be feeling more liberal about using things and throwing them away because they think that there's some solution that's happening on the back end. So both intentional and unintentional greenwashing, and that requires standards of reporting and transparency of reporting, accountability measures. So that's one big thing that has to happen. And the other thing has to really be with, I think, just stronger regulations that requires that sort of thing, requires transparency, requires standard reporting. And I think, the UK NHS is really leading in this way by, having declared that all their vendors of a certain size immediately, and then by, a phased in, depending on the size of the company, needs to be participating in the Carbon Disclosure Project, which is one means of standardized transparent reporting, and have their own decarbonization structures and accountability in place in order to do business. So I think this is the beginning. The other is that, we need product level information to not only help us with our decision-making between products, but also to help us do accounting in our own behaviors and how much stuff we use, and in order to better understand what the alternative treatments are. I'm making it up. Is it better for my patient to go on hemodialysis for the rest of their life versus have a kidney transplant? In fact, there is some evidence to suggest, and there are all sorts of reasons why one would recommend and a patient would choose a transplant over dialysis. So I don't mean to trivialize that whatsoever. But we need the information at the product level to be able to do those types of comparisons. And this has to be part of our duty as healthcare administrators, and as clinicians to minimize our footprint. So it's a combination of all those things. It has to come from industry, has to come from our professional societies to require this information, has to come from regulators that oversee both industry and also healthcare delivery organizations.
So bottom line, it boils down to we need honest sustainability with no greenwashing, and we need regulation to help us there. But it also requires broad knowledge with healthcare professionals and beyond, including patients, I would say. But that requires also transparency and awareness that we are bringing. That's what I heard a lot and will take away. Huh?
Yep, that's a great summary. And I just want to come back. There's one important point that you raised, that we can't so-called decarbonize, which is really the catchphrase that's come up. We cannot decarbonize in silo. We must also be looking at patient outcomes, the performance of our care delivery, the performance of our organization in terms of access and quality of care. Those metrics must be paired side by side. We cannot decarbonize at the expense of patient care delivery. And of course, that's not our intention, but we need the data side by side to prove that we are maintaining or improving healthcare access and quality at the same time as reducing emissions.
100%. And to me, really a great ending also for today, because only environmental measures aren't enough. We also need to cater in the end for the patient outcomes. So big thanks, Jody, that you squeezed us in between you seeing patients, obviously. Very inspiring to me, but also very helpful to understand healthcare pollution more concretely. What are the pollutions, where they are coming from, but also where and how to prevent as professionals, but also as individuals. So that said, big thanks again that you took the time.
Thank you, Thomas.
So thank you very much for tuning in to today's Strategy and Insider podcast. I do hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. And as you know, we also appreciate your support and look forward to bringing much more of those thought-provoking episodes to you in the future. That said, stay safe and hear you soon.
Strategy and Strategy made real.